fine up until last two sessions when my computer went out. We had a little trouble with the second computer today. But I have a few more things to say before we're finished. Can I get your attention, please? Okay, we went through some split brain phenomena last time. I'm sorry we didn't have the handouts. You should all have the handout this time. And of course, this is all on the web. Some of you are asking me about this phenomenon of automatic writing. Let me just, I'll read you the William James quote, which I didn't do last time. Automatic writing was popular in the late 19th century. It led to a number of observations on pain in hypnotically anesthetic arms. That's what was being studied. One such observation was reported by William James. Do you know who William James was? Sometimes called the father of American experimental psychology. He was a Harvard University professor at the turn of the century. He wrote an account of automatic writing in the Proceedings of the American Society for Psychical Research in 1899. His subject, I'm reading, his subject, one Smith, was a student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Smith had prior experience in automatic writing and was apparently able to prepare himself for the experiment without any formal induction of hypnosis. He sat with his right hand, the writing hand, on the planchette, so it was a little thing to write on a tablet, and his face averted and buried in the hollow of his left arm, which is lying on the table. Now, after the writing hand had scrawled illegibly for 10 minutes, James pricked the back of it 15 to 20 times. There was no response to indicate feeling. As a control, James pricked the normally sensitive left hand twice, and the subject immediately asked, "What did you do that for?" James replied that he wanted to find out whether Smith was going to sleep. Later, as the experiment continued, the anesthetic hand wrote, "Don't you prick me anymore." When shown the automatic writing after the session, Smith laughed and said that he had been conscious of only two pinpricks, those on the left hand. He said of his right hand, "It's working those two pinpricks for all they are worth." In a session 2 days later, James had Smith write with his left hand, the other hand. When questioned about the prior session, the hand wrote that he had been pricked 19 times on the other hand. James was uncertain whether the number was correct, but it was near enough. He summarized the situation as follows. We have the consciousness of a subject split into two parts, one of which expresses itself through the mouth, the other through the hand, whilst both are in communication through the ear. So we can see then that you don't have to do a split brain operation to get divided consciousness. And that's the subject of the book by Hilgard that I obtained a lot of this from, Divided Consciousness. He reports a hypnosis procedure using what he called automatic key pressing, and he could get this kind of dissociation in a number of people, even without automatic writing. Many of the phenomena of hypnosis can be interpreted in this fashion, separating different realms of mental activity. They're certainly as dramatic as in the case of split brain patients. And as I think this is where we were when we stopped last time, I pointed out that in child behavior we see many self-contradictory words and actions. In ourselves we see inconsistencies in mood and values. Moods change, values shift, and we say things like, "I couldn't help myself," indicating that I and myself are somewhat different. We might say that was not really me. But I just want to point out that self-identity can vary a lot in these different moods. We can be very detached. We can say, "I'm not myself today. This is just an unusual mood." or we might identify it with completely. So then we can ask the question, does that mean that self is separate from these states of body and brain? You can't help but ask a question like that when you consider these things. Now let's deal with the problem of, okay, we've got these separate moods, different values, different parts of ourselves. It can create conflicts concerning self-identity. We carry with us our parents' values, peer group values, religious values. They're not always in agreement. We have other kinds of conflicts, doing our homework or taking a snack break. We can rephrase a conflict like that in terms of neuroscience. We can say it's a disagreement between separate underlying brain systems on how to control behavior. That has to be what it means. It all depends on the nervous system. Okay. Let me give Gazzaniga's example, the story of George's infidelity, because it makes clear the idea of cognitive dissonance and how we do things to reduce the dissonance. Remember, I said that we have an instinct to feel that we're unitary. We don't like cognitive dissonance. Here's an imaginary example from the book by Gazzaniga and Lido called The Integrated Mind. It's mainly about split brain patients. George is married and full of fidelity. Then a set of circumstances develops that finds George involved in an affair with another woman. George does not believe in such behavior, does not condone extramarital affairs. So, immediately after the experience, George is very much in a state of dissonance concerning his recent behavior. He initially attributes it to being drunk or being seduced. That helps. But George is soon in bed again with his new friend. As the affair continues, his dissonance increases and something must change. What usually changes is George's attitude about his marriage. Before long, he attributes his behavior to domestic tensions and comes to believe they are much worse than he had previously thought. As a result, George shortly finds himself in divorce court. He has concluded that he must be having the affair because his marriage was foul. These rationalizations and actions are the changes that resolve George's dissonance. Divorce becomes an unavoidable consequence. George's fate was sealed, in a sense, after the first night. Now, he could have achieved consonance by changing other values. He divorced because he clung to the idea that married people are, among other things, supposed to be faithful. If he had changed his ideas on fidelity in marriage, he could have achieved consonance. But the reason that's unlikely is because it's part of the ego structure. We don't change our ego that easily. And there's many, many examples that illustrate reduction of cognitive dissonance in our behavior. So why did then he go to bed with Molly in the first place? The reason, and this is quoting Gazzaniga again, the reason we propose is that yet another information system with a different reference and a different set of values existed in George. But because it was encoded in a particular way, its existence was not known to George's verbal system and therefore was outside its control. So we're dealing with, again, two separate systems within the same person. And yet, the assumption is made of unity, so the dissonance has to be resolved. Now, let's talk about abnormal variations in mood and personality. These are pathological states or abnormal states. They represent extreme separations in brain systems with a lack of integration, including memory dissociation. I'm sure you have seen stories or read about fugue states. You might not have heard them called that. These are the states of amnesia, where a person is in an accident and he can't remember who he is. It sometimes takes a long, long time for him to ever recover his original personality. that's a state of dissociation. The other person is still there. He hasn't lost all that. But now he's identifying with a different state. And the memory of the two states is dissociated. Multiple personality is another example of this. It happens mostly in when children are traumatized repeatedly and when they grow up. And one way to cope with that is to develop different personalities to deal with different aspects of that little person's life. There's some famous books written about. The one is called Three Faces of Eve. One is called Sybil. The more recent one is The Minds of Billy Milligan, which I don't like as much because it was written by an English professor who was not a scientist, so he was more concerned with making money from his book. So I don't know really how much to depend on it. But Three Faces of Eve was written by a psychologist. She was very concerned about the accuracy of it, and she's continued to study people like this. We know their real states. Different personalities existing within the same person. When they switch from one to the other, if it happens when they either they go to sleep and the next day they wake up in a different personality, or if it happens during the day, they often sort of doze off and then wake up in another personality. You could interpret possession states the same way. A person seems to become possessed by a demon or whatever. What's happened is he's, of course, that's all within his own brain, but now he's in a different personality. Let's go to another kind of abnormal situation, but now we'll talk about artificial stimulation or depression of normal systems and ask this question, what happens to self-identity? How separate are they? So, for example, here, let's start with this question. I want you to think about it. If electrodes were implanted in your brain and you had no knowledge of the application of electric current when it was being done, how would you know that the states produced were not you? After all, aren't you just those states of electrical activity in your brain? So if part of the brain is altered by artificial stimulation or depression, okay, phenomena very similar to those we were just talking about can be created. Let's talk a little bit about electrical stimulation, drug effects, and hypoglycemia effects, which I will describe from my own experience. Okay, electrical stimulation. I'm going to read to you a few things from the latter part of the last century when they began using brain stimulation to try to treat psychotic individuals. And there's some fascinating literature there. I'm just going to read you a few examples. The first, a few excerpts from a study called Deep Temporal Stimulation in Man. It was done here in Boston. The first example is one with bipolar stimulation of the most medial points in the amygdala complex. Okay, on either side. They gave him, this patient, a male patient, tremendous feeling of relaxation and relief. Pleasurable sensations. A variety of other transient mood or sensory changes occurred, most of which, in contrast to the pleasure and euphoric effects, were strictly limited to duration of the electrical stimulus. Same patient, now another example. Five separate trials of warningless stimulation of medial amygdala by remote telemetry indicated typical relaxation and euphoria on a day when the patient was deeply depressed. No alteration in performance was measured following stimulation on digit symbol subtests of the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. And another test, the matrices test, and this is typical. Cognitive activity is not affected by the stimulation in the limbic forebrain. The patient became increasingly dependent and insistent upon the stimulation of the most medial pair of electrodes on either side. And when stimulation was emitted for 10 days, he became irritable and severely depressed. He was controlled by these moods. Another example, the patient experienced a spontaneous feeling of everything suddenly strange. How many of you have experienced a situation where everything seems suddenly familiar, even though you know it shouldn't be? That's called a deja vu experience. And quite a few of you. It's common when you're growing up. So it is due to anomalous activity in the temporal lobe, but it doesn't mean you're abnormal because so many of us experience it. I've experienced it many times. Well, there's a similar state called, I don't remember the French name, but it's when suddenly everything is strange, even though you're in a familiar environment. And that's with this person. It was triggered by temporal lobe stimulation, and they have been able to get the deja vu experience that way too. Then the more extreme situation, stimulation of a right lateral depth electrode in the amygdala. The patient says this: "I feel detached. It seemed hard to talk. Everything is separated. The handles don't seem to belong to the doors or the frames. I'm a little frightened, feeling as though I seem to be nowhere. I just don't exist. This is a completely new mental feeling. I feel crazy. Everything is very serious. Things are switching so fast I can't keep track. Now I'm in a place all by myself. Somebody else is controlling me and moving my arms and legs. There was no movement visible. I feel morbid. I just want to be alone." Later, the left electrode. "Something is going to happen, but it doesn't. Everything seems so distant. It has no real connection with me or the present setup in the hospital. It doesn't feel like me talking. I seem to be concentrating very deeply, thinking about something very hard, but don't know what it is. You're changing me into another world." And so on. When they stimulated both sides simultaneously, they got even more of a mixture of strange moods and feelings. I'll read a little bit from another article, which was not on amygdala stimulation, but on basal forebrain, and just below the septal area, in the region of the anterior commissure. I'll just read two excerpts. The first target point was the anterior commissure, 5 millimeters lateral from the midline. About 5 millimeters below the assumed target point, the patient developed reddening of the upper part of the body and a sensation of warmth. This was a patient called Ingrid, okay? They went a little deeper. She got goose pimples on the legs, which felt cold. The left pupil dilated more than the right one. At the same time, the patient described a strange feeling related to the visual field, as if she would develop fear of the lights of the operating room above her. And she admitted that the feeling of strangeness was similar to what she got in her epileptic attacks. So they were trying to find areas that matched what they got in their attacks so that they could eliminate, they burned out small areas of brain to try to eliminate the triggers for their epilepsy. Okay, one more. Another target point in the region of the anterior commissure, 2 millimeters to the right, produced again a euphoric feeling, and during the stimulation she said, "Oh, Professor, you are an angel. Please stimulate me again. Oh, how wonderful." 3 millimeters below the target point, she had the same wonderful feeling, at the same time reddening of the face, upper part of the body, and a feeling of warmth. During stimulation, the patient claimed to see a person coming towards her who looked like a red Santa Claus. Immediately after the end of stimulation, this hallucination disappeared. She did not see the background of this man, did not see his face very well, but she believed she had met him somewhere before. This was repeated several times with every stimulation. 1 millimeter deeper and with a somewhat stronger stimulus, she had the feeling that this man was approaching her, that he now reached to her chin, and that she was obliged to fall in love with him. So you can see, these are all just from stimulation of amygdala and basal forebrain. And these patients vary a lot in how well they're able to separate their self-identity from what's happening. Recognition of the self as separate can occur, but it varies a lot. Let me give the example told by the guy who founded our department, Hans Lucas Teuber. He was a neuropsychologist, and he liked to tell his classes about a war veteran. He studied many war veterans with brain damage, but this particular one had a little piece of shrapnel in the third ventricle. And when he would move, this little piece of shrapnel would move around and stimulate the medial hypothalamus, and it would cause him to cry. And when this, early on, when this would occur, he would see it as something separate. And he used phrases like this, "It cries in me." In other words, that's not me crying. Something is doing this to me. But later, he came to identify with that sad state, and he felt he was really, if he was crying, even though it might be due to the shrapnel stimulation, he felt that the state was real and he was really sad. And I just want to remind you that these cognitive abilities are not really affected by these emotional changes. Centrally acting drugs can do similar things. There's some very nice example in Heinrich Kluver's book. Put that reference, it is at the end of the notes, called Mescaline Mechanisms of Hallucinations. Mescaline was the first hallucinogen studied in the last century, latter part of the last century. It leads to a state called mescal psychosis. And there are really three kinds of things that this drug will cause. One is abnormal sensory phenomena, especially visual phenomena. There are also fundamental changes in conscious state and attitudes, and there's abnormal emotional states. I don't think I will read this because they're pretty similar to what I've already described. Euphoria is a typical state, sometimes with no foundation in anything that's actually happening, but you sometimes get the opposite too. People can have very bad trips on these drugs. The experience is sometimes so impressive or even shocking that its after effects linger for years in the memory. But Kluver pointed out that the nature of these trips depended, in his opinion, on, because interviewing many people that had gone through this, on the degree of identification or attachment or detachment from those states. Other hallucinogens can have very similar effects. They're sometimes been called psychedelic, as if they're enhancing mental states. I think it's very doubtful. They act on the brain. There's evidence that they, in fact, can cause brain damage. Mescaline, it was shown in monkeys to produce alterations in the temporal lobe given repeatedly in high enough dose. LSD, lysergic acid, its effects may appear spontaneously long after the person isn't even taking it, you know. Of course, that couldn't occur unless the brain had been altered or distorted in some way. And there's certainly other examples in more recent times that appear regularly in hospitals. Let me give you some personal experience from the effects of hypoglycemia. Many of you know diabetics, and I'm going to give you a few. These are caused by insulin injection. There's many different effects. They're comparable to effects of electrical stimulation drugs or lesions of the brain or lack of oxygen. The effects can be sensory, they can be motor, they can be cognitive, they can be affective, and there can be other changes as well, like changes in sleep and waking properties. The symptoms appear to be altered by the recognition of the self as separate, and this is not well known, it's not well studied. There aren't many neuroscientists like me that have done studies. I've had this for 38 years. Recognizing the self as separate is easy for sensory and motor effects. It's most difficult for affect. I've been in these states where emotion changes and I really feel that's me, and I will behave that way for quite a long time unless something gets worse, something makes me do something about it. The effects can change also over the months and years. They also vary a lot among different individuals. Here's what some of the effects are. First, I'll deal with moderate hypoglycemia. By moderate hypoglycemia, I mean they start beginning to affect the brain, I find, below 60 milligrams per cent. Normal is 90 to 130. So you're all in that state right now, between 90 and 130. Okay, and my and it's probably about 130 right now if I go by the tests I made before class. Okay, so, but when it drops below 60, you begin getting effects on the brain, and the effects are amazingly variable. I would say moderate hypoglycemia I would define as about 45 to 60. Sleepiness, tiredness is the most common, but that's influenced by sleep needs. So if I've had plenty of sleep, other people can confirm this, you don't have the tiredness so much. The most consistent thing I found, and it took me about 25 years to figure this out, okay, so it's not well known to physicians who treat this, inability to deal with novelty. And yet, as long as you're following plans, set plans, you're fine. It happened to me once in a 901 lecture. It was on an overlearned topic of my own research. I got so I could talk again. I was given some sweets, and I talked more rapidly than normal and gave the whole lecture. And of course, I had to start when my blood sugar was still pretty low. So you can't deal with novelty, but you can deal with set plans and habits. There are also autonomic effects. One of them is adrenaline can be released. But there are central effects, brain effects also. The autonomic effects, the adrenaline release, by the way, happens most in people that haven't had it very long or people who are poorly controlled. People like me, who are really careful in control, can experience what physicians have a name for. They call it hypoglycemia unawareness because they feel that you can't recognize these brain changes. Of course, I don't agree because I've learned to recognize many of them. Sensory changes. You can get flickering in the visual field. You can get altered depth effects. I get somatosensory effects. I can feel like I'm light in weight. I can feel my fingers are changing in size. These are all sensory changes. And when those things happen, I know immediately that I'm hypoglycemic. Affective states can be enhanced. I think most of that's caused by adrenaline, and there are experimental studies that show that adrenaline does this. But I think some of them can also be central. Another thing that can happen, I used to be a lot quieter than I am now, but in those states I could become quite garrulous and my whole personality would change. And that somebody who knew me well would know that something's wrong, but if they didn't know me well, everything's fine. Moderately severe. Okay, if we go, here we're getting down below 40 or 45, down to maybe 30. So down to about a third of the normal blood sugar levels. Reduced motor coordination, slowed speech. My speech I can have more and more trouble getting words out until they actually will stop speaking. Disorientation in space, usually if there's any novelty at all, you get disoriented. Loss or reduction in working memory, cannot hold things very long, so you're able to deal only with things that don't require working memory very much. Euphoria or its opposite can occur. And there's some more bizarre displays that I don't show, but I hear some of these reports. I know one woman living in Arizona that my sister told me about who, when she becomes hypoglycemic, she almost always does the same thing. She disappears, she takes off all her clothes, and she comes out in public. Yet, I never do that, but it does occur, and they know what it is every time. But again, she's the only one I know like that, so there's a lot of individual differences. Now, severe hypoglycemia, for me that would be below 30. I've actually been down to 20 with no symptoms that I could notice, but I'm a little unusual in this, and I think it's because I've learned to detach myself from these states. But here's the kinds of things that can happen. Catatonia. What that is, in my experience, is that every choice in front of you has the same value. So there's no way to decide. You can't decide which way to walk, even. Probably pretty similar to catatonic schizophrenia, but we don't know that for sure. Seizure type of movements. Often new diabetics, when they first get insulin, if they get hypoglycemic, they literally lose consciousness and show seizure-like movements called insulin seizures, insulin shock. It's actually been used as a treatment for psychotic individuals by purposely giving them insulin. You can completely, and this is how I became aware many years ago that I was dealing with brain changes. Physicians never told me. I had to figure this all out. Loss of episodic memory consolidation. I became just like Henry M. I could not put anything into long-term storage. So I would repeat things. Couldn't remember from one moment to the next. It didn't take a few times talking with people around me. I figured out that what was happening. Automatic behavior syndrome. Do you remember when I talked about sleep? How some people have that as a problem, if some narcoleptic people, where they will go through periods where they record, they remember absolutely nothing, but they follow habits, they behave. Afterwards, they have no idea, no awareness at all. The feeling is like you've suddenly gone from one place to the other because you've lost all memory of anything in between, and you've lost a sense of time also. So it's in sleep studies, it's called automatic behavior syndrome. I didn't know what to call it until I read it in the sleep studies. Fortunately, I've only shown that about 3 times. Then there's some really bizarre one. For example, I've woken up, and the most dangerous time is if this happens when you're sleeping. And one time it did, and I woke up and I was a different personality. So I didn't recognize people around me. I was somebody different. So it was like becoming some dream figure that I identified with, and very much like multiple personalities. So it can happen in hypoglycemia. What it indicates is that the brain can enter different states. And it's not just that one part of the brain or another part of the brain is being emphasized, but the brain is in a different state. In the extremes, you can begin losing body temperature. If that continues for very long, you end up with death. Everything I've told you about here, I've experienced, except the final one. So how is integration achieved? In the case of multiple personality, usually one self becomes dominant, gradually incorporates the others or vanquishes them. And more usually, as Gazzaniga points out, it's achieved by the verbal system. He calls the verbal system the final arbiter of our multiple mental states, many of which we come to know only by actually behaving. And that way we discover the multiple selves that dwell within us. That's his view. So then I ask, well, can you distinguish yourself from, can you tell that you are different? The reductionists would say, well, we are nothing but the result of neural activity. All our attitudes and feelings are nothing but the consequences of limbic system activity. And if that's true, you could always be fooled by abnormal brain states. You'd always think, this is me. But I would argue that no, the cases that have been studied, in my own case and other hypoglycemics, you find that you can achieve a greater detachment and get diminished control by the abnormal brain states. Of course, it's easiest to recognize that there's an abnormal brain activity going on if you know that your brain's being manipulated. It's when you don't know. That's why when I started talking about electrical stimulation, I said, imagine that you didn't know there were electrodes in your brain and they could be stimulated any time. And then, as I point out, some of these effects are a lot easier to recognize as abnormal than others, and people differ a lot in that ability. Is self-consciousness localized in the brain? Well, Gazzaniga and Lodigadeau simply claim it depends on language. So if the right hemisphere has language, they say it's conscious and has a sense of self. It's a totally circular argument. I would argue we can dissociate the language system from higher functions we associate with the self. Geschwin talks about a case of carbon monoxide poisoning that resulted in a isolation of the speech areas by damaging all the areas around it. This woman became a language machine. She would repeat anything you said to her. She had no comprehension of it. No indication that she had no, that language system when it was isolated was very abnormal. The person was abnormal. It has to be connected with the rest of the brain. An opposite kind of case is Alexander Luria's case in the Soviet Union. of a composer who became aphasic with no language comprehension. And yet, he composed symphonies. So was he unconscious with that ability? I don't think so. Here's Gazzaniga and Ladeau's statement. They say the person is a conglomeration of selves, a sociological entity. And a case can be made that the entire process of maturing in our culture is the process of the verbal systems trying to note and eventually control the behavioral impulses of the many selves that dwell inside us. And that's where they end. I'm going to end with a different thing. I will say that yourself is what you identify with, the properties of your being. Well, if you don't identify with any of these subsystems and neural activity that control perceptions, actions, feelings, memories, thoughts, then we're still left with that question, well, then who am I? According to many religious teachers, achieving that kind of detachment is what the process of enlightenment is about. Let me show you, yoga can be interpreted as, translated as unity, and I give you the book that talks about that. This is not yoga as we usually think of it in the West. Let me show you an image from a Jain temple in Ranakpur, India. I didn't print this out of respect for the Jain and the religion. But I was looking at this actual image in the temple. I was allowed to photograph it, and a Jain teacher who I was with came up behind me, surprised me, because he suddenly asked, "Do you know what that means?" I said, "No. What is it?" He said, "This is Lord Parshvanath." He said, "Around his head are 1,008 cobras. 1,008. He said, "That represents the 1,008 parts of your brain." He said, "And each one of them has to be enlightened in the unified being, which is represented by Lord Parshvanath, and that's enlightenment." These are the references. Obviously, neuroscience has not explained consciousness. Physics hasn't explained gravity and action at a distance, field forces either. We have correlates that fascinate us, can give us insights into our own nature, and that's what I've tried to do here. I hope you retain your interest in neuroscience, and I wish you well in the exam and finishing the term. I have some review sheets that I will post on the web. With the loss of my computer, I wasn't able to do it for this session, but they will be on the web. Thank you very much.
That's good. That made it a little extra better.
I didn't turn it off.
No.
You know.
Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, it doesn't matter if you turn his mic off.
All right. Let's see. Stop. Oh, it's on hold. That's right.